There's a tendency to look at things like welding or steel making and just see, well, brute force.
Right. It's fire and sparks and heavy machinery.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It feels very physical, very tangible. You see the arc, you smell the ozone, and you just think, okay, that's just force being applied to metal.
It feels messy. It feels like the opposite of, computer modeling or something clean like that.
But we have a set of documents today that really just flips that whole idea on its head.
It really does.
We're doing a deep dive into this landmark paper from 1985. It's by Patricius Finsen and Gredhoft. And what they're arguing essentially is that a weld isn't just a construction technique.
No, not at all. It's a high-speed, really chaotic chemical reactor.
A reactor that's operating at thousands of degrees and then cooling down in just a few seconds.
It's a thermodynamic race, a complete sprint.
And if you can't predict the math behind that race, well, your bridge might just fall down. This paper isn't just about melting metal. It's about creating a phenomenological model for the very microstructure of steel.
And that's the key phrase right there, phenomenological model.
Which, I have to say, sounds incredibly dry on the surface.
It does, but it represents a huge shift in thinking.
So, just to orient everyone listening, we're looking at how these three researchers back in the mid-80s tried to stop guessing and start calculating the future of a piece of steel. What was the problem they were actually trying to solve? Because, I mean, people have been welding for decades before 1985. It's not like ships weren't being built.
They were, of course, but you have to think about how they were built. Manual metal arc welding, which is what this paper is all about, it has a staggering number of variables.
So many.
You've got the current, the voltage, the speed you're moving at, the shape of the joint, the chemistry of the welding rod, the chemistry of the steel plate.
It's a combinatorial nightmare. You change the voltage by 2 volts, and does the whole crystal structure change? Who knows?
Exactly. So historically, if you wanted to design a new welding consumable, a new rod, you had to do it empirically.
Which is just a polite way of saying trial and error.
And very expensive trial and error. You'd weld maybe 100 little test plates, cut them open, polish them, stick them under a microscope, and just see if it worked.
And if it didn't.
If the microstructure was brittle, you'd tweak the manganese a little or the silicon, and you'd just start all over again. It was incredibly slow, costly, and it never really told you why it failed, just that it failed.
So Padishia and his team show up, and they basically say, we don't want to weld 100 plates. We want to weld zero. We want to do this on paper.
Or at least they wanted to build a framework where the physics could predict the outcome, not just the experiment. And they focused on these MnSEA alloys,
Iron, manganese, silicon, carbon.
the bread and butter of structural steels.
Okay, so to build a machine that can predict the future, you need inputs. The paper is really specific about this. It says their model only needs three things.
Just three. First, the chemical composition, the recipe. Second is the austenite grain size, and we'll get into what that means.
Okay.
And third, the cooling curve of the fusion zone.
That third one, the cooling curve, that's where the real world seems to crash into the theory.
Right.
You can't just look up the cooling curve of a weld in a textbook. Every welder holds their hand differently. Every machine is set a little differently.
Exactly. That cooling rate determines everything. Cool it instantly, you get something brittle and glass hard called martensite. Cool it incredibly slowly, you get soft, weak iron. The good stuff, the magic, it all happens in between.
So to build and verify their model, they had to measure this curve with extreme precision.
They did.
And the method they used, this is one of the most striking details in the whole paper, they talk about harpooning a thermocouple into the weld pool.
It's such a vivid image, isn't it? But it really speaks to how difficult this task actually is.
It really does. I mean,
Yeah.
you've got a pool of liquid steel at 1600 degrees Celsius. You can't just tape a thermometer
It
to
would
it.
just vaporize. Or at best, you'd get the surface temperature, which isn't what matters. No, the sensor has to be in the absolute heart of the reaction. So they used a platinum rhodium thermocouple, one of the few things that can survive that. And they literally plunged it into the weld pool right as the arc was passing over.
Just harpooning the data right out of the chaos.
They had to capture that thermal history from the moment it freezes all the way down to about 500 degrees Celsius. That's the critical window.
That's the danger zone where all the crystals are forming.
Precisely. In metallurgy, we look at something called the delta 85 value. It's the time it takes to cool from 800 down to 500 degrees. That window is where the war for the microstructure is either won or lost.
And they did this again and again. The paper lists 27 separate runs. They kept the energy constant, about 1 kJ/mm, but they tweaked one specific ingredient.
Carbon.
They varied the carbon from about 0.029% up to 0.1%.
Right.
Which sounds like nothing. To a layperson, that's a rounding error.
But in steel, carbon is unbelievably potent. It's what's called an interstitial atom. It sits in the little gaps between the iron atoms. And a difference of just 0.05% carbon can totally change the hardness, the ductility, the entire timing of the transformation.
So they needed to see if their math was sensitive enough to pick up on the difference made by just a few extra atoms of carbon.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's get into the model itself, the architecture of the weld, so to speak. When that pool of liquid metal freezes, it doesn't just, you know, become steel. It goes through a whole metamorphosis.
Right. At very high temperatures, just after it solidifies, the steel is in a crystal form we call austenite.
The Greek letter gamma.
Yep, gamma. And you can think of austenite as a kind of blank canvas. It's a certain crystal structure, face-centered cubic, and it's stable when it's hot. But as that temperature plummets, austenite becomes unstable. It has to transform into something else called ferrite.
Alpha,
which has a different structure, body-centered cubic.
But it's not a simple switch, is it? It's not like water turning to ice where one thing just becomes another.
No, not at all. It's a competition. As the temperature falls, you have different types of ferrite all fighting to grow out of that austenite canvas. It's a race. And whoever wins that race determines if your weld is tough or if it's going to crack.
The paper points to three main competitors here. And there's a clear hierarchy. There's a boss crystal that shows up first.
Allotriomorphic ferrite.
It's a mouthful.
It is.
So what defines this this allotriomorphic ferrite?
The name itself gives you a clue. Allotriomorphic means it doesn't have its own regular shape. It just takes the shape of the space it fills. And crucially, it starts growing or nucleating at the grain boundaries.
Okay, let's picture this. The austenite phase is like a bag full of microscopic marbles all packed together.
That's a great analogy. The grains are the marbles. This ferrite starts to grow on the surface of those marbles, right where they touch. It basically coats the boundaries first.
And this is where the paper gets into the real physics. They say it grows via a periequilibrium mechanism. This seems central to their whole model.
It is. This is the phenomenology part. See, in a normal, slow process, all the atoms, iron, manganese, silicon, carbon, they all have time to shuffle around and find their perfect spots. But welding is incredibly fast.
Right.
In periequilibrium, the carbon atoms, which are tiny and nimble, they can still move around. But the iron atoms and the big substitutional ones, like manganese, they're sluggish. They're effectively frozen in place while the transformation happens around them.
So the carbon is scrambling to rearrange itself, but the overall iron structure is forced to just snap into a new shape without a full chemical reorganization.
That's a really good way to put it. The boundary between the old austenite and the new ferrite moves too fast for those heavy atoms to keep up. So the model calculates the growth rate based on how fast the carbon can diffuse away.
But why does this one type of ferrite matter so much? If it's just coating the boundaries, who cares?
Because it's a land grab. This is the critical insight of the paper. This allotriomorphic ferrite is the dominant phase. It sets the rules for everyone else. If it grows too fast, it just covers the entire surface of those austenite grains.
It walls them off.
It consumes all the good starting spots. Imagine you have other types of crystals that also want to start growing from that boundary.
The runners at the starting line.
Exactly. The allotriomorphic ferrite is like a wall being built across that starting line. If that wall gets built before the starting gun goes off, the other runners can't even start the race.
It's buying up all the waterfront property so no one else can build a dock.
That's it, precisely. And the model they built, it calculates something they call the parabolic thickening rate constant. It lets them predict exactly how thick that layer of ferrite will be based just on the cooling curve and the carbon content.
Okay, so let's talk about the other crystals, the ones that might lose that race or at least come second. You have Widmansteinite ferrite and acicular ferrite.
Right. Widmansteinite ferrite grows as these long side plates. It shoots out from the boundary into the middle of the grain. It can look a bit like jagged teeth or long needles.
And do we generally want jagged teeth inside our steel?
Not really. It can provide a nice, easy path for a crack to follow. It's not the worst thing, but it's not ideal. The ideal, the gold standard for a tough weld, is acicular ferrite.
Acicular, that means needle-shaped.
Yes, but unlike the Woodman-Stanton plates, it's more like a chaotic basket weave of fine interlocking needles. Because they're all interlocking and pointing in different directions, they are fantastic at stopping cracks. A crack tries to move, it hits a needle pointing the wrong way, and it has to stop and change direction. It just dissipates the energy.
So ideally, what you want is a weld that's full of this acicular ferrite.
You do. But here's the problem. Acicular ferrite doesn't grow from the grain boundaries like the others. It grows inside the grain. It's called intragranular nucleation.
It needs a seed.
It needs a seed. It can't just pop into existence out of nowhere. And this brings us to what I think is the inclusion paradox of this paper.
This was the part that felt the most counterintuitive to me. Inclusions are basically just dirt,
Right.
oxides, bits of slag, things you normally want to get rid of.
In a lot of high-purity steelmaking, yes, you do everything you can to eliminate inclusions. They're usually weak spots where cracks can start. But in welding, this paper argues they are absolutely essential. They act as the nucleation sites, the seeds, for that tough acicular ferrite to grow on.
Okay, so simple logic would suggest if inclusions are good seeds, and good seeds give us the good crystals, then we should just dump a bunch of them into the weld. More inclusions equals better steel.
That is the intuitive leap, isn't it? But the researchers found a limit. The abstract says it really clearly that inclusions beyond a limiting value do not seem to control the overall development of the microstructure.
But why? If you have more seeds, should you get more plants?
Because it goes back to the boss, that allotriomorphic ferrite. The model showed that the final microstructure is mostly determined by how much of the austenite is consumed at the boundaries first.
Ah, I see. So you can have a million perfect seeds scattered inside the grain, waiting to grow into that tough acicular ferrite. But if the boss crystal at the boundary grows too fast and eats up the whole grain.
The seeds never get a chance to sprout. The transformation is what they call site saturated. The rate limiting step isn't the number of seeds you have, it's the thermodynamic driving force and how much real estate the other phases have already claimed.
That is a huge insight for the mid-80s. It completely challenges the idea that you can just dope the metal with good stuff to fix it.
Right. You have to manage the competition between the phases. You have to make sure the allotriomorphic ferrite leaves enough of the grain left over for the acicular ferrite to grow in.
And you manage that competition through what you called the calculus of cooling. Let's touch on the math, because the nomenclature section of the paper gave me flashbacks to university. You see terms like A3 prime, M's diffusivity. What is the model actually calculating?
In essence, they are generating what we call isothermal transformation diagrams. So, picture a graph. The vertical axis is temperature, and the horizontal axis is time.
A TTT
A
diagram.
TTT diagram, yes. And they draw these C-shaped curves on the graph. One curve might represent the start of the allotriomorphic reaction. Another C curve represents the start of the Woodman-Stanton reaction.
And that cooling curve, the one they measured with the harpoon,
Yeah.
that's just a line cutting across this graph.
Exactly. The cooling curve starts at a high temperature and drops down over time. And as that line crosses the start curve for, say, allotriomorphic ferrite, the model starts a clock. It begins calculating, okay, we're in the growth zone. Carbon is diffusing at rate X, the boundary is moving at rate Y.
And it just keeps calculating that until the temperature drops below the finish line for that reaction.
Correct. And it does this for every single phase, calculating the volume fraction. The output is something like, this weld will be 20% allotriomorphic, 60% acicular, 10% Woodman-Stanton, and so on.
So it's an integration of the growth rate over time for each competing crystal.
It is. And the breakthrough was linking the thermodynamics, the theoretical energy states of the atoms, with the kinetics, how fast they can actually move. They didn't just fit a curve to their experimental data. They used physics to predict the curve and then used the experiments to prove the physics was right.
That's a really important distinction. Curve fitting is just saying this happened 10 times, so it'll probably happen the 11th.
Right.
Phenomenology is saying the laws of physics dictate that this must happen this way.
Precisely. And because it's based on physics, you can extrapolate. You can use the model for a slightly different steel composition that you haven't even tested, and the predictions should still hold up.
Which is the holy grail for an engineer. It saves millions of dollars in R&D.
It moves welding from being a black box art form into a predictive science. You can design the welding rod on a computer before you ever strike an arc.
I want to circle back to the carbon for a second. They varied it from that tiny 0.029% up to 0.1%.
Yeah.
What did the model predict would happen, and what did they actually see?
They found that as you increase the carbon, the amount of that boss crystal, the allotriomorphic ferrite, actually decreases.
Wait, really? I would have thought adding more stuff would make more stuff grow.
It's counterintuitive, I know, but carbon acts as an austenite stabilizer. It makes the austenite happier to stay as austenite at lower and lower temperatures. It suppresses the transformation.
So the start line on our TTT diagram moves down and to the right.
It moves to lower temperatures and longer times, which means the weld has more time to cool before that allotriomorphic ferrite can even get started. And because it starts later at a lower temperature, it also grows slower.
And if the boss is delayed and slowed down,
It leaves more room, more untransformed austenite for the other more desirable phases like acicular ferrite to grow. The boss is weaker, so the other players get more time on the field.
but I imagine it's a double-edged sword.
Oh, absolutely. If you suppress it too much or add too much carbon, you risk overshooting and forming martensite, which is that super hard, brittle phase you almost never want in a structural weld.
So it's a balancing act. You need enough carbon to control the phases, but not so much that you make it brittle. You need enough inclusions for the seeds, but not so many that you weaken the steel.
And this entire balancing act is happening in a time window of maybe 5 to 10 seconds. That delta 8-5 value, it's the conductor of the entire orchestra.
It's just fascinating to think about this paper coming out in 1985. I mean, we take computer simulation for granted now. We have finite element analysis on our laptops. But these guys were building the foundational logic for all of that software.
They were. And the rigor is what's so impressive. They accounted for tiny details, like a pillboxing effect of micro-hardness indentations. They accounted for the chemical activity of carbon in enriched austenite. They really didn't cut corners.
And they were honest about the limits. They admit in the paper that predicting the exact ratio of the secondary structures, like telling the difference between Widmansdettin and acicular ferrite, is still really tricky.
Yes, because their growth mechanisms are so similar, that line between plate-like and needle-like can get very blurry at the atomic scale. But just the fact that they could predict the volume of that primary allotriomorphic ferrite with such accuracy was a massive, massive leap forward.
So what's the big takeaway here for someone who isn't a metallurgist? Why should you care about the parabolic thickening rate of a crystal?
I think it changes how you look at the world around you. You know, you walk past a skyscraper, you drive over a steel bridge, and you see this static, solid, inert object.
It looks like a simple gray block of metal.
But inside every single weld holding that bridge together is the frozen history of a violent war.
A war between different crystals.
A war for space. You had allotriomorphic ferrite trying to coat the boundaries. You had acicular ferrite desperately trying to nucleate on tiny specks of oxide dirt inside the grains. You had carbon atoms racing through the lattice to escape the solidification front.
Wow.
And the outcome of that microscopic war, who won, who lost, who got choked out, is what determines whether that bridge stands for 100 years or fails under load.
And thanks to this work by Boetius, Svensson, and Gretthoft, we don't just have to hope the right side won. We can actually calculate the odds.
We can rig the game in our favor.
Rigging the game with physics. I like that.
At the end of the day, that's what material science is. It's using the fundamental laws of nature to force atoms to arrange themselves in a way that helps us.
Well, that brings us to the end of this deep dive into the architecture of the weld. A great reminder that even the heaviest industrial processes are governed by this really elegant microscopic math.
And that sometimes a little bit of dirt is exactly what you need to hold everything together, as long as the thermodynamics are on your side.
A philosophical point to end on. Thanks for listening. Keep asking questions about what's happening just beneath the surface, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.